News, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the National Endowment for the Arts pulls a grant from the Farm Arts Collective, putting their newest production at risk. We'll hear from artistic director Tanis Kowalczyk, and our own Janice Adams, host of the Janice Adams Show and an NEA recipient herself, about what the loss of NEA funding really means and why the arts matter now more than ever. New Yorkers are paying the price, literally, for outdated utility laws that force billions in spending on fossil fuel gas. But the New York Heat Act could flip the script. Coming up, we talk with the NRDC's Christopher Casey about how this bill could reshape your energy bills and your neighborhood for the better. What happens when myth meets machine? We'll learn more about Sunset, a techno elegy at a genre-defying performance at NACL Theater, plus science stories with Joe Johnson. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Roman Catholic cardinals have gathered at the Vatican to undertake the selection of the next pope. NPR's Jason DeRose reports on the papal conclave.
The order of the day. A morning mass in St. Peter's Basilica, the only event that's public. Then a gathering of the cardinal electors clad in their scarlet and white robes in the Vatican's Pauline Chapel. A procession from there to the Sistine Chapel while singing the Litany of Saints with the refrain, Save Us, Lord. Once inside, under Michelangelo's creation fresco, the cardinals sing the ancient hymn, Veni Creator Spiritus. They swear an oath, hands touching the Gospels. A master of ceremonies declares extra omnes, sending out those not involved in the election. Cardinals hear one final sermon, then the voting begins. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Rome.
India has fired missiles at several targets in Pakistan. They're the most significant strikes in more than 50 years. India is blaming Pakistan for a militant attack last month that killed 26 Indian tourists. They were in the Indian-controlled part of Kashmir province. Pakistan denies responsibility. NPR's Dia Hadid says India is claiming its military response is appropriate.
India's army says it struck militant training camps and what they call terror infrastructure, and many of those strikes were in Pakistani-held Kashmir. Kashmir is that Himalayan territory divided between India and Pakistan. It's claimed by both, and it's at the heart of nearly every conflict between the two countries. But Pakistan says the strikes mostly hit mosques and part of a hydropower dam.
NPR's Dia Hadid reporting. Pakistan claims it shot down Indian warplanes, but that has not been confirmed. A U.S. official has confirmed to NPR the Trump administration is planning to fly migrants to Libya. It's another step in its illegal immigration crackdown. The official was not authorized to speak publicly about the plans. Some prior efforts to send migrants to countries they're not from have been repeatedly challenged in courts. The administration has already flown migrants to El Salvador, where they're being held in a maximum security prison. Stocks open higher this morning as the U.S. and China prepare for high-level trade talks. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary and Trade Representative will meet their Chinese counterparts in Geneva over the weekend. It's the first such face-to-face meeting since President Trump imposed a triple-digit tax on nearly all Chinese imports. Cargo shipments from China to the U.S. have dropped sharply since those tariffs took effect last month. Containers arriving at the Port of Los Angeles this week are down about 35% from this time last year. The Federal Reserve is taking stock of the economic fallout from the trade war as policymakers wrap up their two-day meeting in Washington today. For now, the Fed's expected to hold interest rates steady, but investors will be listening for any clues about possible interest rate changes in the months to come. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Four women have accused R&B singer Smokey Robinson of sexual assault over many years. The unidentified women have filed a lawsuit in Los Angeles seeking millions in damages. They say they worked for Robinson as housekeepers in L.A. and in Las Vegas. They also allege that he assaulted them. They accuse Robinson's wife of failing to prevent the attacks. The singer, who is now 85, has not issued a statement. The world is still emitting too much climate-warming methane, according to a new report from the International Energy Agency. NPR's Jeff Brady reports fossil fuel companies are one of the largest sources of methane pollution.
With global temperatures at record highs for 2 years in a row, reducing methane pollution can limit future global heating. That's because methane is an even more potent climate warmer than carbon dioxide. Tim Gould with the International Energy Agency says fossil fuel companies are making slow progress.
We estimate that only around 5% of global oil and gas production can credibly demonstrate that they meet a near zero methane emissions standard.
The IEA projects that even with Trump administration deregulation policies, U.S. methane emissions will decline 35% by the end of the decade because of state and individual company methane reduction goals. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
There won't be a Triple Crown winner this year in horse racing. The trainer for the winner of the Kentucky Derby, Sovereignty, says the horse won't compete in the Preakness next week. But Sovereignty is expected to race in the Belmont Stakes in June. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. We'll learn more about that loss of federal funding for local theater in just a few moments. But first, rising utility bills and affordability are top of mind for many New Yorkers. But what if those high bills aren't just a result of market prices or bad weather, but actually baked into the system by outdated laws? Right now, utilities across the state are required to spend billions maintaining and expanding fossil gas infrastructure, even as the state tries to move away from fossil fuels altogether. It's a system that many experts say is locking us into decades of unnecessary costs and pollution. Some advocates say the New York Home Energy Affordable Transition Act, or New York HEAT for short, could change all that. Its goal is to give utilities the flexibility to invest in cleaner, more cost-effective energy solutions like building electrification instead of more gas pipes and service lines. Joining us today to break it all down is Christopher Casey, Utility Regulatory Director for Natural Resources Defense Council in New York. He's been closely tracking the state's utility spending and advocating for smarter, more affordable ways to power our homes and buildings. Mr. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for that great lead-in on this topic.
Well, let's start with the big picture here. Why are gas bills rising so sharply for New Yorkers, and how do our current utility laws contribute to this problem?
Those bills are going up for many reasons, but right at the top of the list is new spending on new infrastructure, either to expand the system, the utility gas system out to reach new customers, or to replace parts of the system that are kind of old and kind of prone to leak or to break. And it's those, the replacement of this infrastructure and the massive amounts that we're spending on it is really obstructing our ability to transition to cleaner solutions, and it's locking us into fossil gas use and the cost of it for decades to come.
There's something called obligation to serve. What exactly is that when it comes to gas utilities, and why is it becoming such a costly issue today?
Well, the obligation to serve basically means that every utility in New York, and really similarly around the country, have an obligation to give gas service to anyone who is located close enough to their system. But that obligation to provide service also creates a legal entitlement to gas service that is really creating an all or nothing situation when we think about trying to move away from the gas system. And so basically, if we would like to retire a part of the gas system, we have to get everybody who's served by that part of the gas system to agree to do so. And a single holdout can prevent a much more cost-effective project that is aligned with our clean energy goals, and it works to really drive up costs for everybody.
And utilities in New York, as NRDC has pointed out, have spent over $2 billion just replacing aging gas pipes. And these continued investments in gas infrastructure, even in a shrinking system, that's financially risky for ratepayers.
That's exactly right. New York has around 7,000 miles across the state of what is known as leak-prone pipe, which is just kind of old pipe that's made out of materials that, as they get towards the end of their useful life, can be prone to breaking, cracking, and leaking. And utilities are working to replace those pipes very fast because they represent some safety and reliability risks, in addition to the climate damage that leaked methane is doing. But the replacement of those pipes is extraordinarily expensive. Just for example, Con Edison, the local utility for New York City, is proposing to replace 85 miles per year of this leak-prone pipe, and that cost approaches $500 million per year to dig up the street, which is noisy and disruptive, and to replace these pipes. And we could take that money and put it towards electrifying customers. So you just redirect the same money to electrify customers served by that pipe, buy them, you can buy them all the electric equipment they need to meet their heating and cooking needs. You can weatherize their home, all at no cost, upfront cost to these customers. And it would help these customers transition with new equipment that improves the value of their home, but also the comfort of their home, and helps advance our achievement of meeting our climate targets.
And those are some of the Yeah, sorry. And those are some of the solutions in the New York Heat Act. So I want to talk a little bit more about those solutions, that bill in Albany. How does it change the game when it comes to utility planning and affordability?
What the NY Heat Act would do is basically create some paring back of this obligation to serve, so that in instances where it is kind of in the collective interest to move away from parts of the gas system, that can be done. So it would enable these kind of targeted electrification programs that can work to help kind of slowly prune back and downsize parts of the gas system. It'll enable those to scale in a way that will create a funding stream for clean energy solutions, will avoid the high cost of kind of continued investment in the gas system, and it will do it in a way that saves all New Yorkers money and reduces pollution and makes the buildings that we work and live that much more comfortable and enjoyable and affordable.
Some might ask, why not let individual customers choose whether to stay on gas or to electrify? How do you respond to that concern that this kind of reform could limit personal choice?
Well, that is what we're doing now, and that will kind of, you know, always have a path forward, even under the New York Heat Act. But right now, a single customer can hold up projects that are much cheaper, much more affordable, and much more aligned with our climate goals. And so to have, you know, one customer kind of prevent something that is in the collective interest, something that the vast majority of customers who are served by a particular gas pipe would want and are excited about. And then for everyone to have to pay much higher costs because of that is, you know, it's not fair, and it leads to unintended consequences. So, to have kind of one person kind of put their interests above all others is, something that would be very costly to New York as a whole.
We're nearing the end of the legislative session, we think. What's at stake if lawmakers don't pass the New York Heat Act this year? And where does it stand in this current negotiation with the budget process in Albany?
Well, my understanding is that it is not going to be part of the budget, but there is an opportunity to pass this bill before the end of session. The budget took a bit longer than in most years, so we have kind of a short runway to the end of session. But getting this done is extraordinarily important because failing to do so is just going to continue to lock us into higher and higher costs, costs associated with maintaining a big, broad system that is having declining use. And this is really one of the main drivers of people's utility bills. And, there's a lot of focus on electric bills these days, but folks' gas bills are actually rising at a much higher clip than the electric bills. And it's largely because of this, these investments to reinforce and expand the system. So this is an opportunity for New York State to show climate leadership and to do it in a way that advances affordability for all New Yorkers. It's really a win-win-win situation.
What can everyday New Yorkers do if they want to support cleaner, more affordable energy options, learn more about the New York Heat Act and NRDC?
If you want to learn more about this, I would direct you to NRDC's website and a blog I just wrote. You can Google Christopher Casey, NRDC, and pull up my page, and you'll see my recent blog, How the New York Heat Act Can Save New Yorkers from Spending Billions on Increasingly Obsolete Infrastructure.
That's Christopher Casey, Utility Regulatory Director for Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC, in New York. Christopher Casey, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Science Stories with Joe Johnson. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. The fight to defend the legal status of Venezuelans in the United States.
I felt that all these years of advocacy were just prep time for this.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
This is Ari Shapiro with NPR. If you've been thinking about helping this station with a contribution, but now is not the right time for a financial gift, you can donate a vehicle you don't need. Pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Think about it, and thanks.
We accept any vehicle, running or not, including cars, trucks, boats, RVs, motorcycles, and more. Donate at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's time for Science Stories with Joe Johnson, our resident science guy, who brings us stories that caught his eye from that Soviet spacecraft hurtling back toward Earth, and even a controversial signal of life from a distant exoplanet, to carnivorous caterpillars and a Hawaiian spider web. It's weird, it's fascinating, and it's all real science.
This is a pretty interesting story. This is from the April 25th issue of Science, and it's a report of a newly discovered species of caterpillar in Hawaii. And it's rare because it's a carnivorous caterpillar. It eats other insects. Now, if you remember, caterpillars, the adults are moths and butterflies. They're part of the order Lepidoptera, and the adult of this particular critter is a moth. If you remember, butterflies and caterpillars, they start out as an egg. They hatch into a larva, which is what we call a caterpillar. Then they go into a pupa, and they metamorphose into adult. Now, there's about 200,000 known and named species of Lepidoptera, and the vast majority of them are herbivorous. They eat plants. Like right now, the spongy moth, which a lot of people know is the gypsy moth, is an example. Right now, you may see those little tiny black caterpillars crawling over everything. I know we have them at our house. And what they do is they climb up trees and they eat the leaves. But of Lepidoptera, only about 0.13% are carnivorous. Not 1.3%, 0.13%. Tiny, tiny percent of them are carnivorous. So this newly discovered species lives in spider webs. It hunts in spider webs, in hollows and rotten logs and stuff like that in Hawaii. And it took entomologists a long time to discover them because, number one, they're pretty small. They're only about a centimeter long. And they look like a pile of dead bug parts. They camouflage themselves. They scavenge dead insects like ants and beetles and flies and earwigs and termites. And they arrange various body parts of their prey to coat their body. They actually modify them. They'll chew them to get them to the right size and shape. And then they attach them to their body with their silk.
It's remarkable.
It is. And you're looking and at the scary picture, and it's a pretty scary picture. Yeah.
Why do they do this? Do we know?
It's thought that they do this as a form of camouflage. There's actually video of them doing this. They select and they modify the body parts. And then, like I said, they use them silk to weave the body part onto their own body. So you can't even see them at all. It just looks like a pile of dead bug parts. And the camouflage works really well because the spiders generally do not eat them. They very well camouflage. They move really, really slowly, and they're really small. Like I said, they're less than a centimeter in length. And strangely enough, they don't stick to the spider web, so they can walk around on the spider web and not trigger the spider's response. See, spiders hunt by listening for vibrations. If you've ever seen a spider sitting in its web, it just sits there until something vibrates its web, and then it just goes and gets whatever it was. And these guys apparently have evolved the ability to not trigger the web, to not stick to the web.
Because normally you would probably want to avoid the spider.
Exactly.
If you were a caterpillar.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. A couple of interesting points. There's only one per web. When they discovered them, it took a long time, by the way. I was listening to the entomologist. He did a podcast talking about this, and he said that they saw these things for years looking at spider webs, but they never thought they were actually something to study because they thought they were a pile of dead bug parts. But there's only one per web because they're cannibalistic. If there's two in a web, one, the bigger one, will actually eat the smaller one. And they're really threatened, apparently, by loss of habitat. They're only found in the Waianae Mountains of Oahu. Only one island of
Hawaii.
Only
in Hawaii.
Only in Hawaii, and only in this one mountain chain on one island.
Is it expected that this bone collector caterpillar will expand its reach into other areas or stay in this one area?
The strange thing is it's only found in invasive species. It's only found in the webs of invasive spider species. So the native species of spiders, they don't hunt in their webs. And they're trying to figure that out. They think that they may have been on other islands, but they may have gone extinct on an island. It's only about a 15 square kilometer range that these guys are found in. And so they're not sure what their future is going to be.
All right. Another story from space this time. A Soviet probe that's been orbiting Earth since 1972 is soon to re-enter the
yes.
planet's atmosphere.
Yes.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing, Joe?
Well, it could be a bad thing. Okay. This is Cosmos 482. It's a space probe that was launched in 1972 by the former Soviet Union, like you were saying. Now, its mission was to journey to Venus and land on that planet sometime in July of 1972. The Soviet space program was very, very interested in Venus, and I don't know why. I'll talk about that in a minute. But they launched 28 probes from 1961 through 1983, of which only about eight successfully landed. The first one in, I think it was 63, 63 or 64, only lasted 3 seconds once it touched down. And the reason that for that is that Venus is not exactly the garden spot of the solar system. A lot of people know what's going on with Mars, with the atmosphere and the surface conditions on Mars. But Venus is not a nice place. It's very, very hot, over 800 degrees Fahrenheit. It's closer to the sun than we are. And because of its composition, its atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide with clouds of sulfuric acid floating around. It has a runaway greenhouse effect. So it's really, really hot. And the atmosphere is super dense. It's about 90 times Earth's pressure. It's like if you were 10,000 feet under the ocean here on Earth, that's how much pressure the surface of Venus has. So the Russians kept making, the Soviets, I should say, kept making better and better probes. And they got them to last, I guess, almost a day before the atmosphere and the planet just killed it. Now, Cosmos 482 never made it out of orbit. The rocket booster that was to send it, it parked in orbit, and then it was going to launch on its from orbit on its way to Venus. But the booster malfunctioned. There was something about the timer wasn't set right. And it put the booster and the lander into a really highly elliptical orbit. It comes as close as about 130 miles from the Earth, but then it goes about 6,000 miles away. And then it comes back in this really loopy orbit. Now, the booster burned up in the atmosphere back in 1981, but the lander has remained in orbit. And it's projected to return this week. They've been watching this for quite a while now. Now, you got to remember that this lander was designed to survive entry into Venus's atmosphere, which is very dense and very hot and really nasty. So it was probably not going to burn up when it re-enters the Earth's atmosphere.
When we talk about things like this, usually things will burn upon re-entry into Earth's atmosphere.
Right.
But because of this very design point here that we're talking about, it could actually come through.
Yeah, this is a pretty robust spacecraft. This was, like I said, this was meant to survive Venus. And so coming back into Earth's atmosphere is probably not going to be too difficult for it. There's actually a report that says that there's something dragging behind it. They've been able to image it, and they think it may have actually deployed its parachute. So it might even come back slower than they think.
Any idea of where it could land?
Well, it's in an inclined orbit, and it's orbiting from 52 degrees north to 52 degrees south. It's basically orbiting over the equator. So it could return anywhere from 52 degrees north to 52 degrees south, which is the majority of populated places on Earth. That's way up into northern Europe and way down into southern South America. And so they're not sure exactly where and when. The target date, they're saying a window of May 8th through the 12th, with the kind of the median of that of May 10th, which is later this week.
Any idea of how big this is?
It's, let's see, it weighs about 1,100 pounds, and it's the size of a small car. So this thing is not small.
No, watch out.
If the parachute doesn't deploy, if it comes back, just ballistically, then it's going to probably hit the surface going around 150 miles per hour is what the estimate is.
All right, keep an eye on the sky
for a small Soviet car.
last but not least, a little bit of a controversy in the scientific community. Scientists made a detection suggesting some biosignatures or signs of biological activity on an exoplanet located about 124 light years away. Mm-hmm, but now a new analysis is casting some doubt on these biosignatures.
Yeah.
What's going on?
I thought when I first started reading this story, when the press started reporting it and I went and I read the original article, it was like, oh, this is pretty cool. But then a lot of other articles came out and there was a lot of controversy. So this was first in the April 17th where I saw it. It was in the issue of Astrophysical Journal Letters. And it concerns an exoplanet, K2-18b, and orbits a red dwarf star, like you said, about 124 light years away from the Earth. It was discovered by the Kepler Space Telescope in 2015, and it was discovered because it actually transits its star, which means that it passes between the star and the Earth. And so we detected it because we saw a slight dip in the light from the star, slight decrease in luminosity of the star. And it does this every 33 days, so they were able to figure out its orbital period. It's the star that it orbits is relatively dim. It's a red dwarf, so it's relatively dim and relatively cool. But because it's so close and this is so dim, it's in what they call the habitable zone, which I always like to call the Goldilocks zone, because it's not too hot and it's not too cold. It's just right for water to exist as a liquid. And so there is a chance that this was the first planet they ever discovered water on in the hot habitable zone back in like 2019, I think, something like that. It's about 2.6 times Earth's diameter. So in size, it's between the Earth and Jupiter, Earth and Neptune, I should say. A team from the University of Cambridge using this, the James Webb Space Telescope, used a technique called transmission spectroscopy. That's some pretty cool science here. They analyzed the light from the star, and then they analyzed the light that passes through the planet's atmosphere, and they see what parts of that spectrum are absorbed by the atmosphere. And from that, they can deduce what the atmosphere is made out of. And so they're looking at high levels of hydrogen, methane, carbon dioxide, and most importantly, a chemical called dimethyl sulfide. And why is this important? Well, on Earth, the only known source of dimethyl sulfide is algae and bacteria.
So this was the strongest evidence yet that life might exist on a planet outside of our solar system.
Right.
It's now being reexamined. What do these scientists who discovered this say about this reexamination? Are they saying anything about the doubt that's been cast?
Well, I don't think there's been tit for tat yet. I know that there was a conference where there was a discussion, but I don't think they've reached any kind of conclusion yet. You know, like you were saying, other teams have analyzed the same set of data and they've come to different conclusions. They say that the evidence for the dimethyl sulfide is weak at best. And part of the problem comes from the lack of knowledge on the makeup of the planet. There are several different models. Since this is a planet whose type doesn't exist in our atmosphere, we're really kind of making models of it and trying to draw conclusions from that. Some people say it's a Haitian world, which is a new word for me.
Oh,
it's a portmanteau of hydrogen and ocean.
Oh.
So they think it's an ocean world with a high content hydrogen atmosphere. Other teams are saying that it's a magma world with a floating layer of water clouds above it. And some other people are saying that it's a mini Neptune with like basically a small gas giant. And so they're not quite even sure what kind of planet it is.
And it's not unusual for scientific discoveries to be reexamined. In fact, in the science community, that's what is done. Really.
This is science in action. This is science at its best. And the thing is, they're going to need to look at it again. They're going to need more data. They've only been able to gather a certain amount of data because this thing is 124 light years away, and it's a tiny little planet compared to its star.
Some folks are saying that the enthusiasm expressed in making this announcement may outweigh the actual evidence here, and that they just want to be cautious so that the science is, you know, intact and reliable.
Right. I think that the what's happened here is the media, you know, the popular media has jumped on this and said, oh my gosh, life from another planet.
Well, yeah,
and they're going to blow it up and they're going to, it's going to be the thing.
The search for life beyond Earth. We're always interested in that, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's going to happen one of these days. I hope it happens in my lifetime, but I'm not sure this is it.
All right. Science stories with Joe Johnson. Always fascinating. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk to two local theater companies whose funding was suddenly withdrawn from the National Endowment for the Arts. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, this weekend, an unexpected email from the National Endowment for the Arts landed like a thunderclap at two local theater companies, Farm Arts Collective in Pennsylvania and NACL in Highland Lake, New York. They were informed that their federal arts grants already awarded for their 2025 productions were being withdrawn. No explanation, no warning. The funding loss threatens local cultural and economic ecosystems that have grown up around both of these theater companies. And this morning, we're joined by Tanis Kowalczyk, founding artistic director of Farm Arts Collective, Brett Kaiser of NACL, and our own Janice Adams, host of The Janice Adams Show Saturday here at 11 on Radio Catskills. She's also a past NEA grant recipient and, interestingly enough, the first NPR National Arts correspondent. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I want to ask you, Tanis, and Brett, what did this mean to you guys when you first heard this?
Well, for Farm Arts Collective, the money from the NEA was going towards an artistic project called Dream on the Farm. And we had begun the project in the winter, and receiving that information on a Saturday morning, which was a very bizarre time to receive it, I have to say, just really shocked me, because we had been promised. We had, you know, had done the paperwork and had started the project already and had included it in our budget. And that money was one third of our budget for this project.
$10,000, is that
right?
Yes. Yeah. And Brett, what about NACL?
It was, of course, alarming. I can't say that it wasn't fully unexpected, given the course that things have been taking recently. But, you know, nevertheless, we all find ourselves in the same boat, including Radio Catskill. You know, from different sources, but the way that small companies manage themselves is very hand to mouth, and so if you know, you work with what you have, and if you have a grant that's there, then suddenly you can say, okay, we're going to do these things, and then suddenly when you can't, it's not like free money. The money has already been put into play.
Yeah, and you guys are both embedded in the local ecosystem here, your theater companies, but you also support the local economy as well. How does this ripple through for not just your productions, but just the overall ecosystem for the area and arts in general?
Well, I if you think of it as a food chain, you know, we are part of the whole ecosystem, as you say, and to be able to suddenly not have enough money to do a project and to perhaps have to potentially cancel a project, it's just, you know, people A, are not getting paid what they ought to be paid for their work as artists, and that ripples out into what they're spending in the economy. But also, if you're reducing your programming, people aren't going to the coffee shops. People aren't going to the restaurants. They're not going to the gas stations. It just like has this like kind of freeze, this ice age freeze on our lifestyles, our life here. And it's really, really alarming.
Tanis, you brought along what the NEA said they would accept for funding arts organizations. Can you read from some of the NEA's proposals for obtaining funding now in this new era?
Right. So we've been asked to change our change our focus with our artwork, and that we've also been asked as artists to make an appeal. And many advocacy groups have told us that we ought to be writing our appeal letter. So I did that. I sent it in on Monday, along with, I know, many, many other organizations who had been cut. But what they're saying is that the artistic heritage and creativity as prioritized by the president. Consequently, we are terminating awards that fall outside new priorities, which include elevate the nation's HBCUs and Hispanic serving institutions, celebrate the 250th anniversary of American independence, foster AI competency, empower houses of worship to serve communities, assist with disaster recovery, foster skilled trade jobs, make America healthy again, support the military and veterans, support tribal communities, make the District of Columbia safe and beautiful, and support economic development of Asian American communities. This does not seem like an arts mandate to me.
It seems like it's a list of some other priorities of this administration put into one other letter. Brett, what was your reaction?
Well, I mean, as you say, and as anybody who listens to the list there, it's not a real list, and what one maybe can glean from this is that they're not intending on funding anything. They have to put this out there as a sort of screen that says, oh, well, we'll fund these things if they happen to come our way. But I just read an article yesterday that said that there was a Hispanic arts organization that serves the community, I believe it was in Chicago, and their grant was terminated as well. So even what is right there stated in the thing is not true. It's not happening.
Janice, I want to bring you in here on a national level. You have experienced NEA funding yourself. You've reported on arts funding. Is this retroactive funding withdrawal part of a larger trend that you're seeing here? And what cultural impact does it have on arts initiatives like Farm Arts and NACL?
Well, yes, it is. It's part of an historic attack on public broadcasting, which you and I discussed a couple of months ago when we played the excerpt from Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, I just want to interrupt real quick, Janice. I want to focus on local arts, though. We know that's been impacting public broadcasting, but I really want to focus on our local arts theater here.
Well, I think the point being that there is nothing in what they have been told that we can believe except for the fact that their money is being canceled, mm-hmm. period. There is, if you listen to that laundry list of political agenda items, we have to hear HBCUs. Well, HBCUs have already been threatened by the government because they are considered DEI. Their very existence is DEI. So here we have local organizations that are being told something that is not true. The bottom line is that they can no longer count on the government at all, period. That's out. And I want people, even though we're saying local, for us to understand the magnitude of this to not just the organizations, but to the community. Recently, I was on Broadway for a matinee. And getting into that Broadway district is the parking. It's the restaurants. It's the local candy stores. It's all of that. If you extract that out of New York, you have severely handicapped the budget of New York City, and everybody knows it. That, in microcosm, is what is happening here to our local communities. We don't think of it the same way, but Tanis's Center is an agricultural center. It is under attack, even though it would be a model for rural communities throughout this country, Rust Belt communities throughout this country. Pennsylvania is a red state these days. It would be to see, people need to see that this is not just about the theater companies, it's about them. It's about the impact to this community in totality. And by attacking one of us, like the theater community and the arts, whatever art museums and alliances we have, they're going to be under attack too. It's all of them, which means it's all of us. There is no way that just sending letters to a couple of arts institutions will not have a severe impact on the entire community. Calicoon, for example, tiny little town, is uniquely positioned to understand this because our restaurants in Calicoon are there really because the movie theater stepped up and said, we're going to, we're going to come back as an institution. And that then supports the others. If we don't understand that this is, we have two theater companies on the line right now. If we don't understand that this is not about theater, that this is about attacking thought, it's about attacking local economies, then we're not getting the message.
Tanis, Tanis and Brett, sorry, what is it you guys can do? What are the next steps in addressing this funding shortfall, Tanis?
Well, as I mentioned, they recommend that we make the appeal and just put our name.
Are you going to do that?
Yeah, I did it on Monday. Yeah.
Okay.
The advocacy groups like Americans for the Arts, which is a great advocacy group suggested it. And it's just like marking your resistance, just putting yourself in the line of resistance. And I know for us, we're just going to try to make it up by going to our community. And it's already been really very – they've been very generous, a lot of people. It's always the same answer. You know, it's like the problem here is also the U.S. is the lowest – one of the lowest of the G7 countries in their appropriation towards the arts. So it's like – for example, in 2024, the U.S. granted $5.44 per American for the arts, for their experiencing the arts in the country. In Canada, that same year, the distribution was $124 per person. So it's just like we always have to go to other means. It's true. You know, we always have to find other ways of supporting us. But this is more of a... This is a sign. This is the canary in the coal mine of a cultural revolution that's coming from the government.
Brett, are you at NACL also appealing, and what are your next steps?
We have appealed, and as many people know, we operate out of a former Franciscan Catholic church, and our appeal letter stated that we are.
You're qualified for that house of worship thing.
We appealed under the house of worship clause, with no disrespect to any other houses of worship, but we are spiritually uplifting our community through the upliftment of the arts and artists who are creating work today.
Yeah, it's Janice. Janice,
hello.
Go ahead.
Something just happened and the sound was going down, so I wasn't able to hear the end of what was just said. But I do want to make the point that this is illegal. Under the Constitution, everything that we're going through right now is illegal because Congress appropriates funds, not the president. And so what they're really doing, they know that this is going to come back in lawsuits and everything else, but you either have to be in a strong enough alliance to be part of a lawsuit, or you have to have the kind of funding in and of yourself to come back to a lawsuit. They know this. But the fact is that they will have been successfully destructive by just completely detouring every plan. The other thing is that we have to see that from an economic standpoint, and I am hot on recognizing arts not as something frivolous and extraneous, but as part of our economy and as part of our, obviously, our mental health and wherewithal. But by doing this, this whole economy works because places like the NEA give their funding so late next to when they have approved the production or whatever it is that you're getting a grant for to take place, as in Tanis's situation, her production has already been in motion. every small nonprofit operates not only hand to mouth, but on a cycle where they are always robbing people, Peter to pay Paul. They're always taking earmarked funds from one grant to float for the next one to try to cover that. When you say retroactively that monies that these entities have already on a handshake agreement, which is how all of this really functions as well, you are endangering these individual proprietors with theft of service lawsuits. And if we don't really understand the magnitude of what that means, that is crippling to the carpenter who doesn't even really necessarily go to theater. They may or may not love it, but they've been hired to build a set. Mm. And that carpenter, the plumber who has to maintain the outdoor situation at NACL with the mass porta potties that are very nice, but they're outdoor, is going to be affected. This is core to every community.
Yeah.
And it is illegal.
And we're gonna wrap up this part of things here because we actually have guests from NACL's next production coming up this weekend. We want to make sure we talk about that so folks can learn more about what the great work that's coming up this weekend. But also, if folks are listening and want to support or learn more, where can they reach out to you both?
We have a website where people could make a donation. It's www.farmartscollective.org, or email me, tanis@farmartscollective.org.
Right. Same thing for NACL. It's nacl.org. And I just want to remind everybody that Radio Catskill is also in need as part of this ecosystem.
Well,
we're all in a weird
boat. Thank you all so much. Janice Adams, Tanis Kowalczyk of Farm Arts Collective, and Brett Kaiser of NACL.
Thank you for having us.
And we're going to take a quick break and come back with the latest NACL production. More about that after this. It's Radio Catskill.
On the TED Radio Hour, paleontologist Ken Lacavara says a spot in New Jersey sheds light on exactly what happened when an asteroid hit the Earth.
This makes this the best window on the planet into that pivotal calamitous moment that wiped out the dinosaurs and really made the modern world as we know it.
The day the dinosaurs died. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's a live event from the beautiful Pacific Northwest. We're on stage in Seattle with native food experts, standard bearers for the city's incredible Vietnamese and Filipino food, chefs and bakers. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In a world increasingly governed by screens, algorithms, and digital illusions, Sunset, a techno elegy, dares to ask, what have we lost and can we ever get it back? Presented at the NACL Theater, it's a multi-sensory performance by Detroit-based experimental ensemble, The Hinterlands. And I'm joined by two members of that ensemble this morning, Richard and Liza. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
tell us, oops, sorry, we're getting a little feedback there. It's a richly layered work, this Sunset techno elegy. Talk about how this collaboration came together and a little bit more about the technologies that shape the performance, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, I can start. So the performance is a collaboration between The Hinterlands and longtime collaborator Renee Willoughby, who is a video performance artist based in Detroit. And Renee and I have a collaborative project for a bunch of years called Registered Nurse, which is it's a kind of band. But it's electronic music with video and live performance. And so this is an expansion of some of the sonic and visual worlds of that project, but taken into a more theatrical territory. So we're working a lot with electronic music, specifically working with feedback and working with feedback systems around both sound and video, both as kind of the sonic reality and a way for us to deal with and approach the ways that technology is accelerating. So the way that large language models are learning through these feedback processes, we're trying to replicate through the video and audio worlds.
Let's talk a little bit about the themes here and the myths. You're drawing on some ancient myths here. Talk about exploring that and the relationship with technology that informs it.
Yeah, so this work is looking at the stories we tell ourselves about technology. And right now, in our lifetime, both Richard and I were born in 1980. So we remember a time before the internet and ourselves before the internet, and definitely myself before the smartphone. The technology that's come into our lives has changed so quickly, and we haven't really found stories to tell ourselves about what that means or how to integrate this kind of magic, actually, that is possible through the internet, the tomes of knowledge at our fingertips, the ability to be anywhere or contact anyone anywhere in the world at the touch of your fingers. And so we've been searching for different myths that we can play with to try to understand what is happening to us and what we're engaging with. So right now we're working with the Orpheus myth. Well, the Orpheus myth is a organizing mythology that we're using to look at this, and really the loss of ourselves before smartphones, before the internet, the self that got lost, the self that didn't know everything.
And you're also using you're using some more traditional elements like masks and some other audience participation. How does this sort of manifest itself and help inform this whole idea of the performance?
Well, I'll talk about one traditional element we are working with, which is song, and we're working with lamentations and other folk songs as a technology. So thinking about the technologies that we have inside of us and we have culturally that are very, very old and that serve a purpose to reorient ourselves towards the world. And so these songs create a foundation that is knowable for the audience. People understand when they're sung to. People understand something. And so it's a way of grounding these myths and something that is embodied and real.
And this is coming up on May 10th, Saturday at 7:30 at NACL in Highland Lake. There's more information at nacl.org. We ran a little long on that last segment, but quickly, what do you hope folks take away from this at the performance?
I hope that people start to question and how they're working and engaging with technology and to think about who they were, who they could be, how we could be together, and how much we want to utilize this like very, very powerful magic.
Lisa?
I am hoping that people can have a very embodied experience and be just this, the magic of being together in space, vibrating together in sound is super important in these times.
I'll use that right now. Sunset, a Techno-Elegy by the Hinterlands and Renee Willoughby is at NACL in Highland Lake on Saturday. Again, more information, nacl.org. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can find this show and all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180. Building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Jason Dole. The White House, you may have heard, has proposed eliminating federal funding for public media in its budget, issued an executive order to block support for PBS and NPR, and wants to claw back funding that Congress already approved. The threat to public media is real, it's here,
and it is growing. The stakes have never been higher. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org. That's protectmypublicmedia.org. And tell Congress to protect Radio Catskill while there's still time.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, mainly cloudy, a brief shower or two, or possibly a thunderstorm in spots this afternoon, high 60. Mostly cloudy tonight, low 48. Tomorrow, cooler with rain and during the day and a couple of evening showers. But for the weekend, clearing, high in the mid to upper 60s with some sunshine.